certainly one of the discussions that I've just come from was talking about composition of the trustees and experience and likewise of the board. So I think it's very apt that we should be having that, you know, a preliminary conversation around that. And David is going to have a chat about the due process overview committee. And I think I've probably got that. So I'm going to ask to change the order and get Sheila just to have a little talk about her role in relation to the nominations committee on the trustees. Sheila.
Thank you, Joanna. It is a real pleasure to be here. As you can imagine, I have seen all of your names. Probably appointed, been responsible for the appointment of some of you, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about the work that we do at the nominating committee. You may be aware that the nominating committee, on behalf of the Board of Trustees, is responsible for the appointments, the recruitment, and the appointments of the trustees, the board members, the Advisory Council, and the members of the Interpretation Committee. I'll briefly go through. The process is pretty much the same for all of them at the beginning. There is an advertisement that is placed in The Economist, and we send out a notice to what I would call our stakeholders, so approximately 400 individuals, organizations, including trustees, former trustees, the monitoring board, advisory council members, interpretation committee members, as well as the world standard setters. We receive a large number of applications, and many, of course, who do not have the relevant experience. I would say probably that the most impressive CVs and applications that we received are through our contacts rather than through an advertisement, which is probably not surprising to you. All applications are reviewed by staff. All applications are ranked, if you will, not in any order per se, but giving an indication of the qualifications, if the people have the qualifications required or not. And they are all presented in a table to the nominating committee. We develop from that a short list. In the case of trustees and board members, there are interviews that are conducted. For trustees, we do that. Two of the trustees will interview potential candidates, and then a recommendation will be made first to the nominating committee, then to the full trustees. And then from there, the process is a little more complex because we go through a full vetting of the individual. And then, of course, the final approval and recommendation is made to the monitoring board, who then conduct an interview and make the final approval. I would just mention, too, the trustees, of course, you may be aware, in the Constitution, there is a geographic requirement. Six trustees from Asia Oceania, six from Europe, six from North America, one from Africa, one from South America, and two members at large. And as well, the Constitution indicates that they should provide an appropriate balance of professional backgrounds, including auditors, preparers, users, academics, and officials serving the public interest. And I would just mention as well that the whole process of appointment and recruitment is also reviewed and approved by the monitoring board before it is undertaken. Just to give you an idea, in 2004, there were three vacant seats, and we received approximately 40 applications from as many as 20 different countries. For the board, much the same process. Board members are appointed for 5 years with a renewal possible for a further 3 years. The chair and the vice chair can be renewed for an additional 5 years. The process is much the same as for trustees. There is a geographic representation, four from Asia Oceania, four from Europe, four from North America, one from Africa, one from South America, and two members at large. As you're aware, I'm sure it was brought up in the discussions, there is consideration being given as to whether this is the appropriate number of board members, and as well the geographic representation. So there may be some, it's possible there could be some changes to that. There will be board positions coming open, and we will be starting a process once we have an indication of the feedback from that review. Again, the shortlist is prepared. Potential candidates are reviewed by the nominating committee as well as the board chair and vice chair. And then the full recommendation is made to the full trustee group. Again, an indication in 2012, there were 74 applications for five positions. Let me just turn to the interpretations committee. There are 14 members. We recently reviewed the criteria for the interpretations committee to clarify some of the practices that had been in place previously and specified, for example, that accounting firms are limited to five of the 14 seats on the committee, and that at any one time there may only be one individual from each of the large four firms. Regulators would be considered for observer seats, but cannot be members if they are active. Regulators cannot be members of the interpretations committee. And again, it's pretty much the same process as the others. Appointments for periods of 3 years, renewable for further three. The advisory council, I'm sure you're all aware of that, that membership is held by both the organization and the individual. Terms for 3 years and can be renewed once. And both the individual and the organization will be reviewed at the end of each term. We have introduced a staggering of terms, which is helpful in this recruitment because I can tell you there's a large number rotating on and off at any one time, and it does involve a great deal of work for staff and the nominating committee. I would say again, the process is very much the same, and there is interest in being on the committee. There, in 2014, we received 50 applications for five seats. We are looking, and we are considering, as we did with the Interpretations Committee, we are reviewing the composition, the role and the composition of this advisory council. I would be certainly very interested, as I know Joanne would be, in any comments that you might have as to its role, given the introduction of ASAF. We feel that the council probably should be playing a less technical role, but how exactly to define that in relation to the strategic role that the trustees are playing, I would certainly be interested in hearing any views, and I would be quite pleased to answer as well any questions that you might have on the nominations committee and its work. And with that, Joanne, I think you have a couple of comments as well.
Thanks very much, Sheila. Are there any general questions before we actually get on to this council around the nominating committee and what Sheila has shared with us?
I think, sorry, if I may just ask one question based on your experience. What tension is there, if any, indeed, between the sort of desired skill set that you're looking for, I don't know, in a board member or maybe a trustee, versus the geographic requirements that you have? Is that ever much of an issue or not?
In my experience to date, it has not been an issue, though I would say it has been a challenge to find certain people who are interested and who have, I would say, too, the time and the availability to play these roles. Obviously, the board members are full-time, so that's one issue for people to consider. But even for trustees, it can be a pretty significant time commitment. And so it is, I think it has been a bit of a challenge in certain jurisdictions to find people. Certainly, there are people who are well-qualified, but who have not been able to devote the time that we would require.
Jake, sorry.
Thank you. First and foremost, Joanna, thank you for being quite so understanding when New Zealand lost quite so badly in rugby league last night.
I was very quiet about that. Yes.
Great grace. And Sheila, a question for you. Do you find that there are any particular stakeholder groups that are either under or overrepresented on any of these committees and boards?
I would say most definitely we have had a challenge in getting investors. I think investor involvement at any level, even just responding to exposure drafts, I think has been a challenge for the board and for, I'd say, probably most board standard setters. So we are actively looking to have investors at the trustee level, at the board level, and throughout the organization. So if any of you can help with that, we would be most appreciative.
Okay, what I'd like to do, and I know you don't have any material on this, so we may play it by ear as to getting comments now versus perhaps either at the end of this session or at the end of tomorrow. However, what I would like, as Sheila has said, that effectively initiated, and I will emphasise what I would call an informal review as opposed to a public review of the composition of this advisory council, to ensure that we do have the right mix of skills and organisations around this group to really add value from a strategic perspective to both the foundation and the ISB. And obviously linked to that, as Sheila said, is the role of ASAF, and I'm certainly pretty confident in my own mind that we have moved away from that so that we're not from that technical advice. But I'll come to, in a minute, the people sitting around this table, some thoughts around that. But then it does obviously raise the question, if we're purely strategic, then are we overlapping with the role of the trustees? Or in terms of our advice, are we adding to the role of the trustees? So we're providing some additional. So I've jotted down some notes, which I'd just like to go through, of thought provokers that I had around this. And maybe you just think about it and talk about it over lunch. Obviously happy to get some initial thoughts. So the things that are some of my current thinking about matters to consider around this, so challenging my mind, the size. Do we actually have the right number around the table? Are there too many of us or too few? Because you certainly look at here, and Sheila, as the first time person sitting around this table, said to me this morning, gosh, this is intimidating. Why would anyone want to talk? Because there are so many people around the table. And I understand that, and if we all think that and therefore we don't get the participation, are we as effective as we could be, and therefore would we be more effective with a smaller group? So it's that kind of question. Are there too many of us? Are there too few? There is no fixed number, so the Constitution or our terms of reference don't say there is a fixed number. We've tended to operate around the same number, but there is no fixed number. Should we have a fixed number? We also have diversity of thought. That's one of the sessions around looking at this last thing we're in. Diversity of thought, I emphasised, as something that's really, really important for any board. And do we actually have that diversity of thought around here? We have no formal requirement or criteria for stakeholder or geographical representation. Should we? Does the matrix model work? So effectively it is the organisation and the individual that are appointed. Does that actually work? So if you leave an organisation as an individual, you are no longer a member because it is the organisation who is also a member. But likewise, you know, if the organisation ceases to, at that point still a member, has to go through a formal appointment process for a new member. So does that model really work? So that's some of the questions that I have. Some organisations appear to have, through history, permanent seats, others not, and some bodies have rotating membership. Does that work? Currently, and this is one of my key things, because I think it's history as much as anything else, and people think, oh, do you want to be a member of the advisory council? And people think, oh, the technical accountant in my organisation. So an awful lot of us, despite the fact that ASAF exists, are actually technical accountants, whether we are from the auditing firms or we are actually from another organisation. Our role is as accountant. Is that actually what we want if we are not giving technical advice? So have we got that right background in terms of the membership? So those are some of the key thoughts that are actually in my mind around the who is sitting around this table. I think, don't get me wrong, I think it works incredibly well with who we've got, but are we as effective as we could be in terms of what our role is? And at that point, I think I'm going to shut up and actually not get you to respond straight away. As you see, Michelle has actually managed to make the fog through the tunnel. So I suggest what we actually do is allow Michelle to do, if he is ready. Michelle, are you ready to go?
Yep.
Michelle, ready to go, and allow him to give his summary and David to talk about the due process. See how much time we've got and either come back to the challenges I've put to you or Sheila and I are putting to you this morning, or we will actually consider them later on. And certainly, I'm very comfortable to have individual chats or for you to send me an email with your thoughts on those challenges that I've put out to you. Michelle, over to you. Welcome.
Thank you, Joanna. My apologies to you all. It's becoming difficult to cross the channel these days, and I was not expecting to be late. I hate that. So I really apologize for this delay. I'm very glad to be here with you. I suppose you've started dealing with Sheila's issues, so I will go directly to the Board of Trustees meetings. We had two meetings since our last meeting here with you in London and then in Beijing. I know that you have received IDAS sent you the summaries of the meetings, and therefore I will not be too long, rather keep some time for questions. We looked into the review of structure and effectiveness. I have to say that we were very pleased with the remarks you made to us and took stock of these issues before we sent the last paper for consultation. And I think it was very good that Johanna could join us for the discussion before we finalized the paper. We had, as usual on these occasions, stakeholder events. The one in London was special because it was Tommaso Padoa-Schioppa's lecture. As you know, we've started the annual lecture in recollection of our friend Tommaso. I have to say that this one was particularly brilliant. We were lucky to have a lecture delivered by Lord Adair Turner. Those of you who know Adair know that he is a quite remarkable person, a challenging one, sometimes provocative one, and he addressed the issues of the crisis and the evolution since the crisis and made some very strong views, which I have to say I share most of them with him. We have a video on this that you might have seen. If you have not, I would encourage you to look at it. It is on our website. We then had another more classical stakeholder event in Beijing, which went extremely well. We were very glad to have a number of people there. It was organized together with the Chinese Minister of Finance and the Chinese Accounting Standards Committee. It was focused on IFRS and China, ever-changing challenges and opportunities. The participation, as I said, was very good, but the discussion went very well. And I must say I was very impressed by the discussion, both from the technical point of view and from the point of view of the commitment of our Chinese friends to IFRS. I would like to pay tribute to our good friend and colleague Li Qin, who made a very strong statement during this panel with regard to future developments in China and for the possibility for Chinese companies that are internationally exposed to consider the possibility of some kind of option. Of course, this has to be seen by Chinese authorities, but we would, of course, welcome such an evolution in the future. We also had separately a very fruitful meeting with the assistant minister, Mr. Taibo, and that was a very good meeting. We also considered possible options for future developments in China. As we do each time, we considered international developments, and here the situation is contrasted. We have very good news from Japan, where the movement towards IFRS is speeding up. We now have more than 100 Japanese companies using or preparing to use IFRS, which is nearly a quarter of Japanese market cap. We then considered the situation in China. I will not come back to this, but I think that the Japanese experience is something maybe of interest for our friends. And together with the Japanese situation, we also talked about the role of our Asia-Oceania office in Tokyo. We would like to see this office developing its outreach in the region. We now had a discussion on the European situation. We have a number of positive developments in Europe. To begin with, the EU Commission's review of the IAS regulation, which was published in June this year. And this report is globally very positive, and it's interesting to see that different stakeholders have really a very good understanding and a good support of IFRS. We also have welcomed a proposal by the European Securities and Markets Authority, ESMA, to mandate the use of the IFRS taxonomy for certain companies as part of the development of European single electronic format for financial reporting. Well, this is not to say that we are not facing challenges in the EU. On substance, Hans will update you on endorsement of IFRS 9 and the evolution with regard to the insurance industry. I think we are foreseeing positive evolution there, but nevertheless, it's a technically complex situation. We have engaged, as we usually do, with all organizations in the EU, namely the EU Commission, EFRAG, ESMA, and the European Parliament. I would like to mention more specifically the meeting we had with Hans with the IFRS Working Group of the Economic and Monetary Affairs Committee. I think this meeting went well. It was an occasion for us to clarify a few major issues. And by the way, it followed the paper we issued together with Hans on the way the IFRS Foundation is serving the public good. I think this paper provides relevant answers to a number of questions that were raised by some members of parliament. I also attended an EFRAG meeting, which went well, and where we had discussions on the role of the trustees and the way forward. Moving away from Europe, we talked about the situation in the United States, which remains obviously a challenging situation. We are waiting for the further developments of SEC's views with regard to possible developments of IFRS there. But I have to say that the major concern we have today is the issue of funding and the issue of the shortfall of the US contribution to the funding of the foundation. I think this is really something we have to find a solution to, otherwise we might have serious difficulties. As I mentioned funding, we of course looked into the evolution of funding for the organization. The positive is that since approximately 5 years, we've seen 8 more countries contributing to the foundation and a number increasing their funding. There remain some challenging situation here and there, and we try to work with our counterparts to sort it out. It's not always easy because the situation is a bit ambiguous, as you know. Nevertheless, the situation of the foundation is satisfactory. We have seen a new increase in our reserves, and we are progressively moving towards the objective of having 1 year of reserves to be able to confront any major difficulty, and this is due to Yael's and Miranda's efforts to manage this organization as well as possible. As you know, we focused on the strategic overview that goes together with the other exercises we are doing today. This strategic overview deals with 2015 to 2017. The question we discussed really was how can we follow the implementation of this overview, and what sort of metrics could we use, having in mind the fact that most of our activities cannot be really quantified. So how can we manage to have qualitative metrics? And we talked about that, and Yael made a series of proposals that we discussed and approved. Then we had a discussion on our communication strategy, and we had a presentation by Mark Byatt on the way we could improve our communication in the future. I would like to mention the discussions we had with regard to our relationship with the monitoring board, which, as you know, is of the essence for us from the point of view of legitimacy and governance. We met with the monitoring board in June. I also participated on the phone to the meeting they had in Toronto a few weeks ago, and I also met with Massa Kono a few weeks ago. I was looking on the right. I'm sorry, Massa. I didn't see you when I came in, so I must have been a bit. So I think the discussions went well, and we see the evolution of the monitoring board with great interest. And as I said, I personally consider that this institution is of the essence for us, and it was one of the issues we discussed with our European colleagues and counterparts, this issue of the legitimacy of a non-for-profit private organization drafting the rules for countries, and this is always a challenging one, and the monitoring board is very important to justify our role and legitimacy. We will have another meeting with the monitoring board, hopefully in January, here in London. So I think I have summarized most of our discussions. If something is missing, please correct me. And in any case, I'm ready to answer your questions together with Sheila, who, as you know, vice chairs this organization and deals with very tricky issues of nominations.
Thanks very much, Michelle. Any questions or comments of Michelle? Nothing specifically there.
Everything is
Michelle,
perfect.
Everything, yep, absolutely. I might now just get David perhaps to give us a summary of the due process.
Thank you, Joanna. Michelle's problems this morning reminds me of a headline from an English newspaper a century or so ago fog in the channel, continent cut off. On more mundane things, the DPOC had meetings at both the June and October meetings of the trustees, and it's also received reports from the staff every month on all the papers that go to the board that have due process implications. They've done at both meetings an overview of everything on the ISB's technical agenda, and the discussions have focused on certain specific issues. So it's not surprisingly, you know, leases, insurance contracts, the conceptual framework, macro hedging, the work of the transition resource groups, and the ISB's current agenda consultation have all featured. And on the basis of their review, on both occasions, the DPOC has been satisfied that the due process requirements are being met. On a particular issue, you'll hear from Hans this afternoon as part of the technical activities update about where we are on insurance contracts. But one issue that has come up is the relationship between that standard and IFRS 9, and in particular the accounting consequences of the two standards having to have different effective dates. So what's been happening is that the board's put together a proposed exposure draft that looks at a couple of ways in which transitional relief might be provided. And at its October meeting, the Due Process Oversight Committee considered this and was asked whether it would approve a shortened comment period for the ED of 60 days. Now, you could argue insurance contracts been going on for a long time, but you know, this is an issue where, you know, we're cutting to the chase and people want to get their IFRS 9 implementation plan sorted as soon as possible. And the DPOC did give its approval to the shortened comment period, and the ISB followed this through in its October meeting, so hopefully that ED will be out very shortly. The DPOC has also looked at the due process for the IFRS taxonomy, and this has been an ongoing issue for a number of years now, and we're finally at the stage where the DPOC considered and improved a invitation to comment on a proposed changes to the due process for the taxonomy, and that invitation to comment should be coming out, I think, on Wednesday, with a comment deadline in early February. To date, we've had the one due process for the ISB standard setting, and we've had a separate due process handbook for XBRL. Now, we've dropped the focus on XBRL to focus on the content of the taxonomy, and that and various other changes that have taken place have looked at integrating the proposals for the taxonomy much more in line with the standards development, so that these kind of proposals will be in the invitation to comment that comes in. And some of the proposals merely formalise enhancements that have already been implemented in practice. So there are already public consultations on proposed updates to the taxonomy throughout the year, and the process by which content reflecting IFRS disclosures commonly used in practice is incorporated into the taxonomy. So that's something to look out for. Finally, I'd say that at its June meeting, the DPOC considered a number of annual reviews that it undertakes. One is of the ISB's consultative groups. They've looked across the piece at all the groups, and I think as a result, now that leases, Touchwood, will be on the streets before Christmas, that leases working group that's been in existence will be disbanded. As well, the DPOC received reports about the public availability of meeting papers. There have been no meeting papers that haven't been released on the website. They've all been issued. All comment letters received by the board have been made publicly available. And finally, the DPOC also looked at the level of the ISB's interactions with securities and prudential regulators, which I think demonstrated a very high level of outreach and activity. So that's all I wanted to say. Happy to take any questions.
Any questions of David? No. Michelle, I'm going to ask you the question that I always ask you, which is around whether or not there are any particular issues from a trustee perspective, and I'll actually include Sheila in the question as well, that you believe that the advisory council should be involved in. And before you answer, I've got a couple of comments. First of all, you commented earlier about the communication strategy, and we obviously have a session on that communication strategy tomorrow, I think, and certainly listen with interest, but I also believe that the council can probably give some valuable feedback around that strategy, given that a large number of the people around this room, if you like, are recipients of that communications, or their organisations are, and therefore I think hopefully we can give you some feedback on that. I also notice in the paper that, and I don't think you actually talked about it, that you talked about the possibility of the foundation undertaking or commissioning a survey of the impact of IFRS in investment lending and other capital allocation decisions. And I wondered whether that is something that the council could or should be involved with in any way in terms of providing some thoughts either around how you put that survey together or actually helping in terms of the impact, you know, the answers or the thoughts around that. So those were two things that I'm giving you some clues as to how you might want to answer, Michelle.
Well, generally speaking, I have always had the view that the input by the Advisory Council was extremely valuable, and that you have the right to look into all the issues in relation to the development and the functioning of IFRS. So I would expect that you will be involved in the work we will do when we look at the responses to the review, which is something we'll consider in January, and probably we will have to come back to you and tell you where we are and how we consider these responses and what sort of orientations we want to take. Obviously, communication is of the essence. Now, I hesitate because we have had a discussion here in this council whether the advisory council was there to support IFRS or to advise IFRS. And we clearly said that the people around the table are free to support or to criticize, and that they are not there to do the job of the IFRS Foundation itself. Having said that, I think that whatever contribution this council and these members can provide with regard to communication is welcome. I'm always surprised by the difficulty for us to convey the messages to the relevant people. And I suppose it is because we all are involved in this in on a day-to-day basis. We are dealing with it through all sorts of venues, and we tend to believe that the message we send are well received and understood. But our counterparts receive also a host of messages from other institutions, and their priorities are not necessarily ours, and sometimes we have the feeling that we have provided them with the relevant explanations, and when we talk to them, we are surprised to see that they are not aware of it. We were, I have to say, quite encouraged by the reactions we had to the paper on working in the public interest, because there was a number of people who received this paper and were interested by it, and if not convinced. So I think whatever role this council can play to help us disseminate our information and explain to the people who are working with us what is the orientation, even if some of you may have different views or even contradictory views, so that there is transparency and mutual understanding. And I think this is really something you can play a role on worldwide. Looking at the activities of this council, I saw the Hans presentation and the number of meetings we have worldwide. Well, this is a lot of work, but it's obviously not enough. And we can't do all of it. I mean, we cannot be worldwide present at any time with all stakeholders to explain in such a way that they fully understand where we are. And here you can play a role, I think, which is essential. With regard to this research we would like to start and the effectiveness of our standards, obviously you can help us also. We've started, as you know, working with the investors with this initiative that was launched a few months ago, and that seems to be quite successful. There is always, to my view, and maybe this is a French mindset, there is always a difficulty to convince people that when we serve investors in an appropriate way, we also serve other market participants. And sometimes for ideological reasons or other reasons, people tend to say, well, you focus on investors, what about the others? And we know that, in fact, when we deal with investors, we provide all sorts of stakeholders with the relevant information they cannot get because they are not insiders. And this is really the main philosophy of public communication, of transparency. This is something also where you can probably help convincing people that we are dealing in the best interest of the public and focusing on investors, but also serving the interest of other market participants. I think this is something you can help us to develop.
Thanks for that, Michelle. And certainly, I think that around the communications, our session tomorrow around the communications, if we can all think about, you know, both that the strategy of the foundation, but how we can add to that. And I'm also looking at Anne. I think in terms of Anne's presentation to us tomorrow, it's about the communications and what you and your group are doing around the communicating and getting the message across. So I think that will be useful for, you know, us to hear from Anne what she's doing and what else that we can do in that arena. Okay, we have about 10 minutes before we are scheduled to break for lunch. What I wonder is if any of you, me having raised those, if you like, questions or matters of interest to me around us sitting around this table, whether anybody has any immediate thoughts that they would like to share with the group or questions, further questions to ask as things that they think that we should be thinking about to ensure that the mix of people around this table are as effective as we can be in terms of the advice that we can give. So any comments, initial reactions to that? And please don't be shy. Thank you, Peter.
John, you and I have had some of this debate, so widen it out. And what I'm going to say may seem contentious, so I apologise in advance if anybody feels offended by this. But as a council, most of the people around the table represent some kind of body, either a regulatory body, a trade body, or something like that. We obviously have the big accounting firm, auditing firms as well. In my case, I'm representing the Investment Association in the UK, which is the buy-side groups and investor group. So the sort of questions I think we should think about as a council is, if we have this grouping, then should the people representing those bodies be executives of those groups themselves? So my predecessor, for example, was Liz Morell, who is an executive of the Investment Association, who's massively capable, I'm sure contributed a great amount, or should it be somebody who's a member So in this case, an active investment group. Now, I am now retired from my investment group, and hence one of the reasons I'm stepping down is I'm too far away. And I'll be replaced, I think we've agreed, with an individual from BlackRock, which I think will make a huge contribution. So the question is, should it be executives from the groups, or should it be people who actually are working in those member bodies? And also, what about stakeholders who, certainly in my opinion, are hugely important to the IFRS Foundation, who are not represented by trade bodies because they just don't have trade bodies? And perhaps the most obvious grouping of people that I've discussed with you, Joanna, is non-executive directors, and in particular, chairs of audit committee, who are rather crucial in the cog of how the financial statements work and how investors evaluate and the whole governance process. But we're not long of people like that sitting around the table. So I think for all of us to think about, what is the grouping of people we should have, and from those groups, what are the sorts of people that should represent those bodies? And I don't have an answer to that, but I think that's something we should all think about. And I think that we have been very effective as a group. We did our evaluation, so it's not as though there's an awful lot wrong, but we do know that there are some who habitually been quite quiet, and we need to address whether that's because there's too many people around the table and they're too scared to speak up, or whether they don't feel as though they can speak on behalf of the membership, which is obviously a slightly more substantive issue. So I think that if we're going to review it, we probably have to get to answer some of the difficult questions and not just the easier ones.
And that, I think, between Sheila and I'm speaking for Sheila when I say this, is definitely the intention, is to actually think about what the hard ones are, and that's been really useful, Peter. Thank you. Jake?
Thank you. I guess one sort of question I had in my mind when you were sort of laying out your various different thoughts yourself was, I've observed on occasion that the advice from this council sort of tends to flip-flop between different views. So on one occasion, we're encouraging far more involvement with the ISB, with the integrated reporting councils. On other occasions, we sort of say, take more of a watching type brief. And I wondered how that interrelated with the sort of general terms of members here, and whether actually that was a function of that. You're getting different people around the table, so you're constantly getting different views coming back, and how useful the IFRS Foundation and the ISB found that, I don't know. And one other comment, I think sitting around this table, it is certainly difficult for people to get involved. I certainly know the first meeting here, I was biting my lip thinking, I really must say something, and what am I going to say that's not going to embarrass me and the organisation that I work for? What I would say is I've found the breakout groups are far more useful in terms of getting diverse views, and the more that we can use those sort of smaller groupings to break down that barrier of interaction, I think the better.
And just on that note, with Jake saying, you know, it is hard sitting around to ask questions sometimes, and thank you for sharing that, Jake, saying biting your lip and saying, am I going to say something that's, you know, not going to embarrass me and my organisation? And I get that, and I guess me having come in as chair, I have no option but to open my mouth, so I have to. However, therefore my comments earlier around, yes, we're talking about this now in plenary session. However, I really do mean, you know, and it may very well be that you can't get to come and chat with me today. I don't make myself available or whatever, or you don't have the thoughts. But please, 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 on an individual basis, any emails to send through, and it would be really, really valuable, I think, for us to consider your thoughts for those of you, you've been sitting around the table for a while, you know, the mix and what you think, in fact, about, you know, your own role and how you can contribute, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I think would be really, really useful in making sure that we do get this to be as effective as we can be. Any other specific comments that anyone would like to make now? Sheila, as a result of, you know, what I've said and you know, the two comments from Peter and Jake, do you have any final comments before we wrap up and go to lunch?
Well, I just reiterate, as Joanna said, that this is informal. I will be discussing it with Joanna and Yale and others over the coming months. I don't expect that we will have anything even to present to you for some time, but I think we need to think about this and try to ensure that the council continues to be effective and useful to us in our work. Thank you.
Yale, anything you'd like to add in this session before we go to lunch? You amaze me. All right. In which case, let's break for lunch and